You are listening to a Bible talk recorded at the 2013 Western Christadelphian Bible School at Manuka. This is the fourth class in a series given by Brother John Popel on the subject Solomon and Delilah. This class is titled The Bewitched King, Telling Interactions with the Watchman and the Daughters of Jerusalem.
Good morning once again. By the way, quick show of hands. You can't. Ouch. This is a woman's face. That is obvious. Yes, you can see that. I didn't realize anyone was struggling to see this was a woman's face. No big deal. She's lying down. Her eyes are this way. Her mouth is over there. She's also moving. Now look what I've done. I really shouldn't have done that, should I? Mea culpa, I regret. Okay, let's get back to the song. It is lovely to see so many of you still here with us, both those down below and equally importantly, if not more so, those up above. I always feel very honored and privileged to be able to have the teens in a group with me. I really enjoy that and realize that if I were taking the teen group separately, not a single word would change. And that's probably what makes this an easy thing to do, because I think by the time you hit those teenage years, your mind is clearly capable of absorbing anything that I can see in Scripture. So it's good to see you. And the reason I don't make eye contact with many of you up there is simply the presence of that light. I can't really see you. So I'm speaking more in hope than in knowledge that you're up there. Let's go forward on that basis. What we're going to look at this morning is we're going to solve a little cliffhanger that we left on yesterday about the disappearance of the man by the door. And that's going to segue very naturally into just looking at the support characters. We haven't looked at all yet. We haven't looked at the watchmen of Jerusalem. They play an important role. We haven't looked at the daughters of Jerusalem, nor even the few very small contributions made by, quote, others. Some call them friends. I prefer to call them witnesses, either way. But each of these contributions, though small, plays an important role in establishing and corroborating the model that we're looking at. And finally, through that, we'll see that, in a way, despite the efforts of the watchmen, despite the daughters of Jerusalem, despite the cry of the witnesses, we'll see Solomon collapse, at least in his leadership role and his bedazzlement at this amazingly beautiful woman with whom he's very deeply and genuinely in love and from whom he receives reciprocal love. He cedes all authority to her. And the power dynamic, I've spoken of this before, we'll see the hard evidence for it. The power dynamic changes from his leadership directly over to her. So that's what we're going to do this morning. Let's push on. This is a repeat slide from yesterday, just to get us some momentum back into where we were. The two of them want to meet. She's inside in a bedroom or in the house, and he's on the outside knocking to come in. He wants it to come in. She wants him to come in. But the curious thing happens that by the time she gets the door open, she says, my lover had left. And so we pose the question, where did he go and why? So let's start off by trying to solve that question. Now, the answer is never going to be definitive, simply because if it was definitively obvious, it would be there in the text and we'd know. But I think there are enough clues by which we can make some sensible suggestions as to what's happened. In order to do that, let's take a little step backwards and introduce this new group, or this group that's been there in the song and that we haven't considered yet, the Watchmen of Jerusalem. Now, by theme, the Watchmen, as we know in Scripture, are the protectors of a city. Ezekiel 33 is perhaps a key chapter by which we can understand their role. And an important feature of that role was that they were actually obliged to defend the city with their lives. That's not just that they should fight to the death, but if they had been found to have performed insufficient defense, then their lives were forfeit. Anyone whose blood was shed in the city because the watchman wasn't doing a good job, then the blood, says God, would be on their head. So it was a literally critically important role. The precedental mention of the watchman in Scripture, ironically, is by Solomon. Solomon has written Psalm 127, which says this: unless the Lord builds the house, its builders labor in vain. Unless the Lord watches over the city, the watchmen stand guard in vain. And what I take from that he's saying is, if the city loses its desire to have God watching over it, and the spiritual leader and the literal leader of the city is the king, then the watchmen have no power. They are rendered powerless. And we'll see how this becomes a true prophecy in the song, because the king turns away from God, and there's really not much that the watchman, or the police force, if you like, can do. It's worth noticing, we're in chapter 5 trying to solve this mystery. Back in chapter 3, there's some background that the bride and the watchman have met before. The bride speaks, and she says, all night long on my bed, I looked for the one my heart loves. I looked for him, I didn't find him. I'll get up now and go about the city through the streets and squares. The watchman found me as they made their rounds in the city. Have you seen the one my heart loves? She says. Scarcely had I passed them when I found the one my heart loves. That gives us information, a little bit of information we can use. We now know that the watchmen learn that the bride and the king have nighttime rendezvous, and we now know they see that the king and the bride are a couple, that the bride is intent on union with the king, and that the king is vulnerable to this desire. And I'm seeing this mainly in a spiritual light now. I'm seeing this as, remember, this woman is not a daughter of Jerusalem herself. She does not know the God of Israel. In that sense, spiritually speaking, she is a threat to the man of faith, since the man of faith has no intention of sharing his faith with her, we've seen. So it's Solomon who is culpable by refusing to witness his God to the lovely person he has met. And as a result, therefore, the watchmen have already seen this is a danger. This is a danger to the city, spiritually speaking. It's the king who's at fault, but the situation is still desperate. So that's where we are. That's the information we have about the watchman and the watchman's knowledge of the bride and the relationship she has with the king. Pretty scant information. The storyline and plotline in the song is barely discernible. I opened for my lover, but my lover had left. She continues, I looked for him but did not find him. I called him. He did not answer. The watchman found me as they made their rounds in the city. So that's all we've got. Is that enough? It's not enough for any definitive answer. But what it tells me is this. We know what the watchmen know about these nighttime rendezvous, and we know about how they won't be approving of the relationship. He knocks on the door. By the time she gets the door open, he's gone. And when she steps out to find him, not necessarily immediately, she runs into the cops, if you will. Therefore, what's happened to him? Yeah, he was logically, the watchmen have hurried him out of the way. The watchmen have taken, they're the ones she finds when she goes outside looking for him. That's far from definitive proof, but it's all we've got with the little shreds of evidence we can piece together. The watchmen have snatched Solomon away, with intent, I suggest, to save him from a union that they can see will be destructive or is being destructive to his faith because of his weakness. And as a result, on their meeting with the bride the second time, there is actual conflict. In fact, whether it's poetry or reality, I don't know. I don't mind so much, since we're really in the spiritual plane now. They beat me, she testifies. They bruised me. They took away my redid, my shawl, my cloak, those watchmen of the walls. And as we looked at before, the only other appearance of this Hebrew word for translated cloak is in Isaiah 3. In that day, says God, the Lord will snatch away Judah's finery, the linen garments, the tiaras, and the shawls, or the redid. Now, what we've got in a scene is a group of men beating a woman in the streets. Now, from my cultural perspective, which is probably exactly the same as yours, that is nothing short of, I am immediately pre-programmed to put in my sympathies with the woman and against the men. That is what I am culturally pre-programmed to do. However, speaking purely as an objective Bible student, I can't help but notice the watchmen do what God does. The Hebrew is the same. God says, I will snatch away the radid. She testifies, they took away my radid. That's the only kind of detail we have. But Bible echoes are important. And so I think this is an invitation for us to consider that the watchmen, whose lives are on the line if they perform poor defense of the city, as per Ezekiel 33, are doing what they can. And this is, I'm not sure whether this happened physically or whether this is just part of the poetry, to defend the city and try and save their foolish king, who's intent on plunging himself into a relationship that will douse his faith. They attempt to save the city, they forfeit their lives otherwise, but they're powerless. They don't succeed. And therefore, in a way, they fulfill the very psalm that Solomon wrote. Whether it was written by this time or not, I don't know. But Solomon wrote, well, if the leader of the city turns away from God, there's nothing the watchman can do. And how funny that we see exactly that, not funny, what a poor word, but how ironic that we see exactly that occurring in the song in front of us. There's something else that's missing from this interaction, which we might be able, we could speculate about an explanation. What's missing from this reaction, from this interaction, is Solomon's further interaction with the watchman. Let me be a little bit more candid. David, you can be the king of the city, all right? Yeah, that woke you up, hey, right. You can be the king of the city, and I'll be the chief of the police force. I'll be the chief watchman with my crew. And you have your beloved, whose naturally curly-haired goats descend down Mount Gilead in her flowing locks. And you find me and my henchmen beating your beloved. We're 3,000 years back, so there's not a lot of social codes here. You're the man, you're in charge. So, in your opinion, what happens to me? I'm in trouble. Do you notice that English restraint? If you beat and bruise and bloody my beloved, you're in trouble. I like that. I enjoy that. Yes, as John said, a serious view will be taken. And yet, the funny thing is that's what's missing from the song. Now, not everything needs to be in there. We don't need to make a big deal out of this. But it's got to be slightly surprising that there is no retribution visited upon the watchman by Solomon. Like I say, it doesn't have to be in the song, but it's definitely not there. Under what circumstances might the watchman not be punished by Solomon? What could possibly explain Solomon's reluctance to execute the men who've been beating his beloved, whether in poetry or reality? Guilt. We've seen it in his father David, and his father David's inability to apply justice where necessary. This doesn't prove it's true, but at least it is an explanation that makes sense, and it's consistent with the model. If deep down he knows that's actually not a union I should have formed, it's pretty hard to punish those who were trying to do the right thing. And I think that's why we just have this awkward standoff where he sort of rescues her and takes her away, and there's actually no consequences. The watchmen are powerless. They can't carry on doing what they were doing because Solomon overrules them. But Solomon doesn't punish them at all. So that's just something to think about. Take that away and have a think about how those complex dynamics work. Now then, the daughters of Jerusalem, the bride also has a relationship with them. And again, it doesn't seem like it's a very comfortable one. There's friction, there's tension here. Look at the words. I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, if you find my beloved as to what you will tell him, for I am lovesick. What kind of beloved, this is their reply, excuse me, what kind of beloved is your beloved that thus you adjure us? You're familiar with the word adjure. Where has it appeared in the Bible, which in famous? At the trial of Christ. And there, and regardless of the fact that it appears there, the point about adjuring is it's when you compel an oath from someone. They don't necessarily want to give an oath, so you compel it from them. So in other words, this doesn't happen in friendly conversation. I didn't adjure anyone during breakfast, you know, and hopefully you didn't suffer any adjurations there either. It's not a friendly conversation. So I see her saying, well, what do I see? To adjure is definitely to compel an oath when not freely given. This dynamic has friction. The bride wants to control the dialogue. I adjure you, daughters of Jerusalem, if you're going to talk to my man, let's restrict the dialogue to you saying that I am lovesick, which I am. I don't want you. She's just been beaten by the watchman. She's aware that she's not welcome in this city. And again, I'm seeing this in a spiritual context. And so their reply, again, doesn't seem all that friendly. It seems of the nature, may I paraphrase, who on earth do you think you are to demand an oath from us? We're the daughters of Jerusalem, and you don't even belong here, nor do you worship or know our God. So I might be reading too much, decide for yourself, but that's on the evidence of what I'm seeing here. And then as she concludes, this is the last verse of that dialogue, this is my lover, this is my friend, O daughters of Jerusalem, and reading that without emphasis is a rather insipid statement. And so the emphasis, the underlining is entirely mine, but I think that's how the phrase comes across to it, is that she's staking her claim. This is my lover, this is my friend, O daughters of Jerusalem. Or to paraphrase, back off. Don't interfere. I am in love with this man, whether or not you like it. Okay, so that's the kind of somewhat fricative relationship that we're seeing between the bride and the daughters of Jerusalem. Here's the oath itself to which she adjures them. Daughters of Jerusalem, I charge you, and that comes out as adjure again in the New American Standard and a couple of other translations. I adjure you by the gazelles and by the does of the field. Again, there's no swearing by God. There is no God recognized here. Do not arouse or awaken love until it so desires. The traditional reading of that verse is to say, it's saying don't begin love before it is ready. And I can see how that extracts naturally. There's a possibility that the do not arouse, awaken love can also be seen by some as do not awaken my love, which would be him. Don't wake him up, which would be a spiritual way of saying, I can see he's mesmerized by my spell. Don't you wake him up until he so desires. That's an interpretation I very much prefer because it fits my theory perfectly. However, and it's available from the Hebrew, but most of the experts, and since I've gone to them and deferred to them in translation, I must even let go. And they go for the rather more less dramatic. What it's saying is, do not disturb our lovemaking. Okay, so it's a rather more simplistic form, but that's really how they would say that breaks down. So I will defer to that since I've promised to do that. Beloved is aware of the king of Jerusalem has mesmerized her. She adjures the daughters of Jerusalem not to split them up, not to disturb them. In favor of this interpretation, it must be said, this is the best interpretation for matching the context. Here are the verses where this oath appears, 2:7, 3:5, 8:4. Let me show you the verses 2:6, 3:4, and 8:3 that precede. For each time that oath appears, the verse directly before does suggest the immediate onset of an intimate encounter. Here are the verses. His left arm is under my head and his right arm embraces me. That only makes sense really if she's lying down. So he's supporting her head from beneath with the left. His right arm is coming around to embrace. And then the oath is issued. Don't disturb this, daughters of Jerusalem. In 3:4, when I found him whom my soul loves, I held on to him, wouldn't let him go, until I had brought him to my mother's house and into the room of her who conceived me. So she's taken him back on this occasion to her private chambers and then issues the oath, daughters of Jerusalem, do not disturb this. And the latter one, almost identical to the first, in fact, let his left hand be under my head and his right hand embrace me. Do not disturb. Okay, so in actual fact, the more simple translation fits the context very nicely, and so I suggest this is perhaps the one we should take. And here, finally, in terms of the groups of people, the friends, as they're usually called, or the witnesses, as I will call them, they make a couple of comments. Some of them seem quite benign and supportive, but as the song proceeds, this is perhaps the last infusion they make into the song. And I remember when I was first reading through this again and again and again with hope to dig deeper into this book, I do remember coming across this verse and saying, yep, this verse will never, ever be on a slide of mine. I am absolutely confident I will never crack what this means. because it is absolutely obscure and you cannot trace this to other parts of Scripture. It is the verse that says, come back, O Shulamite, come back, that we may gaze on you. Why would you gaze on the Shulamite as on the dance of Mahanaim? So we have a couple of questions. What this seems to be addressed to her. Everyone agrees on that. I'm not going to challenge that. So this is her label. The bride is at this point, she's called the Lebanese bride 5 or 6 times. But on this occasion, she said, we could also see you as the Shulamite. Okay, so who is the Shulamite? And when you look this up in a concordance, you'll be delighted to find there are 0 mentions in the scripture outside of this verse. So you've got nowhere to go. And what is the dance of Mahanaim? Now, Mahanaim exists in other places in the scriptures. The dance of Mahanaim exists nowhere else. And so we have to take this complete unknown and this complete unknown and say, why should this unknown match this unknown? So as you can see, the parameters are getting a little out of control already. So the chances of us coming to certain understanding is difficult. But I think there's interesting things we can see. One of the suggestions, and this won't matter to me either way, is the Hebrew Shulamite merely a feminine version of the name of Solomon? Solomonite in a feminine form, as we might say in English. Some say yes, some say no. Well, there we go. That's helpful. Amongst those who say yes, we actually find the Septuagint translation of the Bible, you know, the Bible where both Testaments are produced in the Greek language. And that becomes interesting because then, it's no longer Hebrew, of course, this is Greek, then the name comes out as Salome. And Salome is a name you might know. Who was Salome? Yeah, she was the one who danced for Herod. And presumably it was an erotic dance because he was so entranced with her that he promised her up to half his kingdom. And the result was that John the Baptist's head was lopped off because that's what her mother wanted. Now, her name, Salome, doesn't appear in the New Testament scriptures. We have to dig it out of the histories of Flavius Josephus. But if you take those as reliable, then that's who that was. So that would be an extremely interesting comparison, that this dancing Shulamite would have the same name as Salome. Can't prove that, but the suggestion is certainly there. Here, however, is what I think is the scripturally important message of the Shulamite and what it's about. And it all has to do with Solomon, which makes sense. And it all has to do with Solomon's early reign. This is very early on in Solomon's reign. It's even before he's prayed for and received wisdom, which may be relevant. Adonijah, his half-brother, says, please ask King Solomon. Adonijah is talking to Bathsheba, Solomon's mother. Please ask King Solomon, he won't refuse you, you're his mom, to give me Abishag the Shunammite as my wife. A highly inappropriate request because Abishag the Shunammite had been married to David, King David, his father, even though that relationship hadn't been consummated. King Solomon swore by the Lord. Look, at this time he's swearing by the Lord. That's before the Lord phases out of his mind and he swears by the does and gazelles of the field. May God deal with me, be it ever so severely, if Adonijah does not pay with his life for this request. So King Solomon gave orders to Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, and he struck down Adonijah and he died. Okay. So what's the precedent? A royal prince is executed for choosing a bride he should never have had. Can you see why this has clear, resonant reason to be relevant to the Song of Songs? And so what I'm suggesting is that Shulamite and Shunammite are used as a deliberate wordplay with each other. Let me first justify that's something that's commonly done in Hebrew. Many of you will know this, but let's look at a couple of biblical examples of where this happens. What do you see, Jeremiah, says God? I see the branch of an almond tree. You have seen correctly, says God, for I am watching to see that my word is fulfilled. That sentence makes no sense at all in English. It remains utterly obscure. Only when you look at the Hebrew do you see what they're doing. What do you see, Jeremiah? I see shaked. You have seen wisely, Jeremiah, for I am shaked. That's the point. It's not the same word. It's a deliberately similar sounding word, and that is the way this Hebrew word game goes. I heard an English equivalent once. This was rather an irreverent one. I think it was some conversation between comedians, and one, following on well from Karam, one was saying to the other, well, you should be meek. He says, I'm meek? I don't want to be meek. Aren't they the ones that inhibit the earth? And that's That's the same word game, two similar sounding words, there to create humor, and here to create a message. Another example, Micah wishes to give due warning to the areas around, and he says, "Tell it not in Gath, in Beth Ophrah roll in the dust, those who live in Sarnan will not come out." That's not very memorable in English, but I bet each resident of those towns would remember it in Hebrew. Let's just insert some of the Hebrew words. "Gad it not in Gath, in Beth Ophrah roll in the Aphir, those who live in Tsarnan will not tsar." And he goes through this list of towns, and each time, it's not a pun, it's this Hebrew cultural thing of giving them a very memorable thing, and I can remember that as long as I remember the Hebrew words that go with it. So let's take that into the song. What we're saying, or what I'm suggesting to you, is that Shulamite is indeed used as a reference, as that cultural wordplay on Shunammite. Come back, O Abishag, that we may gaze on you. It's not literally her, but it's an accusation. Isn't this the same type of deal as when your half-brother did the same thing and you had him executed? Are you going to issue a death warrant for yourself, Solomon? Or would you rather let that one go? Many other people see this comparison too. In fact, if we look at the NIV Study Bible footnote, there's a very interesting comment that this could be the Shunammite, a young woman from Shulam, or maybe meaning Solomon's girl. In ancient Semitic languages, the letters L and N were sometimes interchanged. Well, that's the icing on the cake. The bad news is I haven't been able to ratify that from any other source. And I have seen areas where Semitic languages interchange letters, and L doesn't interchange with N, it interchanges with something else. So this is not certain in my mind, even though it's printed in a study Bible. We need to take it with some caution. But if so, that would be absolutely lovely. Either way, it forms an accusation of hypocrisy. Solomon executes Adonijah for taking, or even didn't even get as far as taking it, but wanting to take the wrong girl as his bride, and then he does the same thing. And so they call her the Shulamite. Okay, so that's maybe half of it. Come back, O Shulamite, come back that we may gaze on you. Is this a reprise of Abishag, the witnesses say? Why would we look at your bride, the Shulamite, as we might the dance of Mahanaim? Now, Mahanaim has a rich history, and I had many slides on Mahanaim, but I had to cut them out for reasons of time. I'll throw in just one in a minute, after this one, obviously. This, I think, again, is the relevant history. And it's straight back in the beginning again, in the early reign. At the same time that he's executing Adonijah, he's also executing Shimei, in fairness, on the instructions of his father. King David says to Solomon, "Remember, you have with you Shimei, who called down bitter curses on the day I went to Mahanaim. You will know what to do to him. Bring his gray head down to the grave in blood." Because of Mahanaim. So Solomon says to Shimei, "You know in your heart all the wrong you did to my father David." Then the king gave the order to Benaiah, son of Jehoiada, and he went out and struck Shimei down and killed him. So what then do we see? Mahanaim, the history, this is just very brief. I'd like to give this more time. But it means two camps or two armies, and some of your Bibles will transliterate that as two camps. And it actually has, even though it started positive when Jacob said, "Surely the camp of God is here with the camp of men," it turns into a sour history very quickly. In great fear and distress, Jacob divided the people who were with him into two groups, two camps at Mahanaim, because he was afraid Esau was going to come and destroy him. And that history remains the same. Interestingly, when Abner decides to crown Ish-bosheth and divide the kingdom of Israel after the death of Saul. Interestingly, David is crowned at Hebron, and so Jerusalem is open and available. But no, this happens at two camps. When Israel again becomes two camps, maybe by the hand of God, Abner anoints the wrong king, as it were, at Mahanaim. Again, the kingdom is divided. And Mahanaim is the first place David flees to when the kingdom is divided again under the revolution of his son Absalom. And that's where Shimei attacked him. So the actual time, here's a picture of Mahanaim for those, and that might help understand the fact that clearly David was on one side of the hill and Shimei was on the other, I think, if that's what we understand from this. Shimei pelted David and all the king's officials with stones. So David and his men continued along the road, while Shimei was going along the hillside opposite him, cursing as he went, and throwing stones at him and showering him with dirt. That was the offense that cost Shimei his life at this place of two camps where Israel has always been divided, spiritually as well as physically. Mahanaim, Israel's house divided once more, and the throne is denigrated by Shimei's blasphemy. In passing, and I can't suggest this strongly, I never did find the dance of Mahanaim, but I'm not making a joke when I'm saying I wonder if it's a sort of an ironic, almost sarcastic reference to David's fleeing retinue jumping around and dodging the rocks and the dirt that Shimei and his crew were flinging at them from the opposite. I wonder if it is this very dark reference to that being the dance of Mahanaim. That's purely a suggestion, not enough to make that a strong case. If so, then, that gives us enough to understand this statement is a very powerful indictment. Come back, O Shulamite. Come back, that we may gaze on you. Now, why would we consider the Shulamite just like the dance of Mahanaim? The Shunammite was the forbidden bride which Prince Adonijah improperly tried to marry. Solomon executed Adonijah for his crime. Mahanaim, where the throne was abused and blasphemed, and the kingdom once again divided, which is what Mahanaim means, by Absalom's rebellion and Shimei's attack. Solomon executed Shimei for his crime. Solomon has now exceeded the crimes of both Adonijah and Shimei. He has once again divided Jerusalem between those who want to stay true to the God of Israel and himself, who will go off and worship the gods of all his wives in time to come, and he is again thereby taken a bride he should never have taken. In fact, you know, this guy gets executed for one bride. Solomon will commit this crime literally 1,000 times. Consider the weight of guilt Solomon bears for his hypocrisy of dividing the city of David with the Shulamite marriage when he's executed people for doing either of those things. I think that's what this verse carries, a very deep and meaningful verse. That's a lot of information to take in a few minutes. So please, by all means, go consider that at some length and digest it. But that I see now is a very beautiful verse. I always think, brief aside, that how beautiful you find something is proportional to how well you understand it. An element of mystery is always attractive as well. But the more you feel that you get an understanding of what's going on, and so I feel, even though this comes out to be a very dark verse now, it doesn't make me like it less than when I had no clue what it was about. When I had no clue what it was about, I didn't really have a great attachment to the verse. But now that I can see the complexity of this picture and the deep spiritual message that it appears to carry, I'm very attracted to that verse. It's not just about whether it's happy or whether it's darker in flavor, but because I feel I have at least can suggest an explanation for it, I love this verse and this book the same way, very much more than I did before when it was just opaque. And so here's the theme that we get. The idea, we're going to look now at the transfer of power from the king to the Shulamite bride. The bottom line being, he is bedazzled by her. And perhaps this is time for another little aside statement, that there's a great irony in this book. If it's true that this book is saying, amongst other things, there's a danger to being bedazzled by beauty, how ironic is it, and therefore how typical of the God that I feel I know a little bit, that he presents it as a bedazzlingly beautiful song, right? This bedazzlingly beautiful song is telling you about the dangers of being bedazzled by beauty. We can either be bedazzled by the beautiful poetry, which is beautiful, or, as well as appreciating the beauty, we can also hear the inherent message. That would be a very ironic setup, very similar to what happens in Job. Why isn't Satan in Job explained in the first chapter? Why are we never told who he is? Because the process of understanding Satan must necessarily be lifelong, and therefore he can only be revealed at the very end, because that's going to be our experience. That's the irony with which God instructs. While the king was at his table, she says, my perfume spread its fragrance. You get the sense of this beginning of pervasion from her to him. But by now, that was chapter 1, in chapter 7, your hair is like royal tapestry, he says. The king is captured, held captive by its tresses. So he openly confesses, I am the captive, you are the captor. That's just one verse. We don't want to read too much into one verse, although we see clearly this: the king describes himself as a mesmerized captive of hers. But there's a series of verses now at this latter end, and then we're going to see a big structure, our final slide, where we put all this proposal together of this power transfer. There's a couple of others that should catch our attention. He is speaking, your eyes are the pools of Heshbon by the gate of Bathrabim. Well, there is no place called Bathrabim. Heshbon's in Moab. So again, that's not the greatest thing, that it's outside of Israel in a foreign land. Bathrabim, the house of rabbis. I didn't recognize rabbi there with the M on the end, because that's how the Hebrew pluralizes. The house of rabbis. So her eyes have become his teachers. He's looking to her for teaching. Her eyes are now at the gate of the house of teachers. And it still has this foreign flavor. Heshbon, that's Moab. That's not Jerusalem. That's not God's teaching. That's not deriving that way. And similarly, in the final chapter, she says, place me like a seal over your heart, like a seal on your arm. That certainly speaks of great commitment and union. But a seal, or if you like, a brand, that's fair enough. But notice who brands who. The owner always seals the owned. She owns him, right? We know this. This is a biblical idea. We actually want to be the ones who are owned by God. And the angels will put a seal on the foreheads of the servants of our God. God is the owner. His seal goes onto the owned. The owner seals the owned. She wants her seal branded, if you like, onto him. So there is a power dynamic explained in this verse. So these elements are all coming together saying the same thing. And there's one more aspect of that we should look at. I really enjoy this. This is very beautiful. You'll be familiar, and we haven't looked at them yet, of those strings of verses of poetry where there's the description of the body in many little sequences. So let me introduce what might be a new word to you, because it was a new word to me not so long ago. This word wasif, it's an Arabic word. It's not, by the way, the Williamsburg amended statement. No, don't do that. That's a very bad idea. We'll just cut that out of the recording. It's an Arabic word which means a poem, but necessarily a poem that has a sequential form. So if I'm going to say something to John and then to Rachel and then to an empty chair and then to Patty and then to Marie, that has a sequential form in the sense of seating order. So any poem that's describing something with an evidence of a linear sequence is called a wasif. And there's a few of these in the song. In particular, generally they go from him to her. And the two of consequence are in chapter 4, 7 verses, feel free to look them up, and chapter 7, the first 9 verses. And I want to point out before anything else that between them lies that center verse. Chapter 5, verse 1. I have come into my garden, my sister, my bride. I have gathered my myrrh with my spice. This was the verse stating their union. Remember, it's the literally in Hebrew, it is the center line. Half the poem is before, half the poem is afterwards. And there's a very different state of affairs in the two halves. Let's look at one way in which that comes out. First of all, in the wasif that occurs before, he describes her sequentially, but he describes, this is the extent that he describes, from the top of her head, from her hair, if you will, down as far as her breasts, and no further. But in chapter 7, and you can see for yourself, he describes the full extent of her body. What does that mean? What's the relevance of that, if any? I think that's a very elegant way for him to reveal, in gentle poetry, the extent of his familiarity with her. Before their consummation, part of her. I am fully familiar with part of her. After their consummation, her entire body is something that I have experienced. I think that's a very gentle and elegant way to suggest that, and that's why this is a limited wasif and this is a fully extended version. Also, but here's the other second point, do you notice the direction of the sequence? In the first, he describes her eyes and her hair and her cheeks and her teeth and her left clavicle, or whatever that is, I don't know, and her breasts, right? And yet by the second wasif, he describes her feet and her thighs and her navel and her waist and her breasts and that funny one over there, I don't know what it is, and her teeth and her lips and her hair and something else. You can look them up. That's her neck. Oh, yeah, good enough. I might need to shift that one. And then finally he returns again to the breasts and the mouth, and I think that's merely to accentuate the sexual, the erotic nature of the poetry. But you can see the difference between the two, not just in their extent, but in their direction. Before, he describes her from the top down, which is almost in a way natural. I don't want to say he's looking down on her, meaning that derogatory sense, but the average guy is taller than the average girl, and he is the king, so it's appropriate that he sees her from above. But after their union, for some reason, he's level with her feet, which gives you one of either two pictures, right? That either he's collapsed at her feet in sort of worship of her, and he sees her from the feet upwards, or, to say the same thing another way around, he's sort of created a 90-foot image of her in his mind, Nebuchadnezzar style, and he's level with her feet, and he's gazing up in glory as she's up above him. That one goes from bottom to top. So I think that I see that, and have a feeling to have a go at reading through, that this is a very clever depiction. We've already seen three detailed verses of the power transfer. I am above you. I see you from above. I am beneath you. I see you from beneath. Certainly not proof, but it's an interesting poetic structure. That's just a sort of a looking at the literary critique of the development. So all I want to do, and this is our last slide, is in a way summarize and aggregate some of those things that we've seen just to emphasize this point that I'm trying to make, that the first half of the song, chapters 1 through 4, has this entirely different power structure between the two of them than the last four chapters, chapters 5 through 8. And in the middle, therefore, this center verse, I have come into my garden, my sister, my bride, I have gathered my myrrh with my spice. In the first half, he leads, and only he leads. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 times he gives an instruction of leadership. Come with me, come with me from Lebanon. Some of those are duplicated. But after this key center verse, she leads, and only she leads. Come, she says in chapter 7, and indeed come away in this, the final verse of the song. I think it's relevant. You might say, well, you know, as long as they're going the same way, does it really matter who's leading? Some strength to that argument, but they're leading in very different directions. He's the king of Jerusalem, so he's calling her, come with me from Lebanon. Come with me from Lebanon, my bride, and join me in Jerusalem. But when she leads, she's Lebanese, and she hasn't been introduced to anything valuable about Jerusalem or Israel. She hasn't been shown the God Yahweh or anything that he might manifest, and therefore, naturally, she's leading away from Jerusalem here in the second half. And as we'll see, that will be the dominant force. We saw before, I think in just yesterday, how in the first half, chapter 4, he praises her beauty as akin to the Tower of David. And yet, in the second half, here we are in chapter 7, he praises her beauty as akin to the Tower of Lebanon. Look at the transfer. From the house of David in Israel to the house of Lebanon. And if tower can be taken as a metaphor of power, which I'm going to try and argue tomorrow, so I'm getting a little ahead of myself, there's a power transfer here. Israel rules, Lebanon rules. And finally, in those wasifs that we just looked at, before the consummation, he sees her from above. After the consummation, he is looking up at her from beneath. So in each of these four independent analyses, albeit they're very some of them are very small details, we're seeing a complete inversion of the state of affairs in their relationship before they've before they fully consummated, and afterwards. Here then perhaps is the poetic description of the power of sexual love, that after they've joined together fully in sexual love, his directives have utterly transformed. As he himself declares, "You captured me with one glance of your eyes. The doves, the new path, were in your eyes. And when this fully came together in full union, entirely an opposite state of affairs, entirely opposite set of directives was in play." So those are the things that I see. And don't think that this is details only. There's only 117 verses in the song. 25 of them are represented on that slightly jumbled slide. If you add to that the eyes being the pools by the gate of Beth Rabim, and you add to that the seal that she adds on his arm, and you add to that the fact that he testifies that he's captured by the tresses of her hair, that's three more verses, in fact four. So you have 28 or 29 out of 117 verses on this same theme. That's a substantial proportion, approximately a quarter of the song that you're looking at right now, singing to that beautiful transfer structure that we're seeing. Not beautiful perhaps in spiritual terms, because it's going very much from light to darkness, as I've tried to convey, but still some amazing imagery and some incredibly beautiful poetry that carries that message. And so we've basically covered the song all the way up to, but not including yet, the final chapter. So what we're going to look at tomorrow will be the final chapter, the final dynamic, the way it concludes, and much more importantly, perhaps even than everything that's gone before, the big picture. To some extent, we've seen what this is all about. What role does the Song of Songs play in the canon of Scripture? What message does it bear, and what message does it give most clearly to us? That much, hopefully. There is one big overriding picture that we haven't looked at all yet, and it's going to involve Samson as well, which is why there'll be some justification to this otherwise rather loose title of Solomon and Delilah, and we'll see how this all comes together. Thank you very much for your close attention.